inspiring the next generation through space education. This week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah El-Ahmed of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. As the school year draws to a close, it's the perfect moment to look skyward and reflect on the power of space education to spark wonder in young minds. We'll share a look behind the scenes at the Griffith Observatory School Program, which serves tens of thousands of students a year. And hopefully, it'll give you some good advice on how to spark curiosity in the hearts and minds of the young people in your life. Then we'll check in with the ever-insightful Bruce Betts for What's Up, so you can know what to watch for in the upcoming night sky. And here's a fun fact. Did you know that Bruce Betts, our chief scientist, has a side hustle writing kids' space books? You'll hear more about that later in the episode. But first, let's get into this week's space news. I love this story. A meteorite from the Eta Aquarius may have struck a New Jersey home. This annual meteor shower, which peaked about 2 weeks ago, is caused by the Earth passing through the debris left behind by the comet Halley. Some of that debris includes rocks that are large enough to actually survive burning up in the Earth's atmosphere, and one of these rocks may have made its way into the bedroom of a New Jersey home. Nobody was injured, thankfully, but the 10 by 15 centimeter or 4 by 6 inch rock is now being examined to determine its origin. Imagine just chilling in your bedroom when, bam, a space rock. That sounds like the origin story for a superhero if I've ever heard one. And speaking of space rocks, planetary defense experts met last week to talk about the close pass of asteroid Apophis, which will pass by Earth in 6 years. The Apophis T6 workshop brought world experts on asteroid research together virtually in their annual meeting. Apophis will fly by Earth in 2029, and you may want to mark your calendars, because this thing is coming closer to Earth than our geostationary satellites. Don't panic, though. This isn't a don't look up situation. The data show that Apophis will not, I repeat, will not, hit the Earth for at least 100 years. This is really good news, but this close pass does present an opportunity to study the thing. Usually, analyzing an asteroid up close requires traveling far beyond Earth, so this is going to be fun and scary for everyone. And reporting this next story does make me a little sad, but NASA's Dragonfly mission to Titan may be facing delays. The agency's 2024 budget request includes a nearly 20% cut to the mission's budget. The Dragonfly team, which is based in Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, says that this could impact the mission's launch date. It's currently slated to launch in 2027 and arrive at Saturn's moon Titan in 2034. I don't know if my heart can take waiting any longer than 11 years for this mission to go into full operation. The thought of a quadcopter flying around one of the weirdest moons in our solar system is literally what gets me up in the morning. But as always, you can learn more about these and other stories in our May 12th edition of our weekly newsletter, The Downlink. Read it or subscribe to have it sent to your inbox for free every Friday at planetary.org/downlink. Now, when I talk to space fans and ask them how they stumbled upon their deep passion for science and exploration, I usually get one of two answers. One, Star Trek made me do it. Or two, someone taught me something so mind-blowing about the universe as a kid that I was never the same after. In my case, maybe both. But as the daughter of a teacher who grew up to spend years teaching space science to kids, I know the power that education has to improve lives and inspire the next generation. Not far from our headquarters in Pasadena, California, is the famed Griffith Observatory. It's home to the most looked-through telescope on Earth, but there's so much more to that building. The observatory is an iconic landmark in Los Angeles, not just because it's the best place to take a selfie of the Hollywood sign, although it totally is, but also because it's a place where people from all over the world come to learn about space. What a lot of visitors might not know is that Griffith Observatory also runs one of the biggest school field trip programs I have ever seen. And full disclosure, before I worked at the Planetary Society, I was a museum guide at Griffith Observatory. I taught in their school program for years, and frankly, it was one of the most meaningful experiences of my life. Our next guests are Dr. David Reitzel, the observatory's astronomical lecturer who plays a huge part in the content creation and vision for the program, and Ella Ritz. She's the school program content coordinator and also the communications coordinator for the observatory's nonprofit partner, the Griffith Observatory Foundation. Hey, David and Ella, it's really wonderful to see you both again.
Likewise.
Nice to see you. It's great to be here.
I worked at Griffith Observatory for many years doing all kinds of awesome stuff with both of you, but I think the time that I spent working on the school program was some of the most meaningful work I've done both at the observatory and literally anywhere. Do you guys feel the same way?
I do completely. The school program is the program I manage at the observatory that gives me the most joy, frankly. We have people visiting from all over the world, but seeing those school kids get changed literally during a visit to the observatory and have their eyes open to the universe is really special.
I started as a museum guide, and it was my absolute favorite shift to do. The school program, seeing their eyes light up every time we blew their mind about something. And so getting to contribute to that is one of the greatest things.
So Dr. Reitzel, what is kind of the mission of the observatory, and how does the school program fit into that?
The mission of Griffith Observatory is to inspire people to ponder and to contemplate the universe. The school program fits in as, for some of these kids, for some of these students, it's their first exposure to the universe as a thing that can be explored and learned about. It's special for them. It really is. We have folks coming back to the observatory in all stages of life, commenting on how their first visit was back when they attended the school program.
Ella, you taught on this school program. You went through the whole day-to-day of teaching the kids. So what's kind of an overview of what this program does for students?
We have a gallery tours portion. So we take them all throughout the building. They see a planetarium show in our Samuel Ocean Planetarium, and they also see a live comet demonstration in our Leonard Nimoy Event Horizon Theater. It's a really wonderful, personalized experience, and they get to meet different members of our staff and experience all the many facets of Griffith Observatory and explore it for themselves.
The program has had to make a lot of changes in the last few years. You know, when I was working on it, it was an in-person program. We were taking kids in and out of the building, but then everyone's aware, COVID pandemic happened, and unfortunately, Griffith Observatory had to be shut down for a time. How did your team kind of grapple with this? And what does the school program look like now?
The school program right now is actually back to being in person. And we have students in the building 2 days a week for the rest of the school year this year. So it's very exciting to have the students there. And next year, we intend that to be the case as well. If you want to find out exactly what that'll be, I encourage folks to sign up for Griffith Observatory Foundation's newsletter, where announcements like that'll be made. But you're right. Pandemic hit, the building closed. We had to close the in-person school program. We couldn't run it at all. I rapidly knew we need to create something. I worked with our curator at the time, Dr. Laura Danley, to explore how we might want to go about doing this. So we invited teachers, and we had a meeting with teachers to find out what requirements they would have for a remote program, what would interest them, how much interactivity, those sorts of questions. Soon after that, Laura let me know that she was going to take the early retirement offer from the city. The city was in financial need to have some folks do that. And she thought, this will give me a chance to do other things. It would fall on me to create this program is what I'm getting to. So I knew I needed to assemble a team, and I knew I'd need help both with organization, content creation, and managing everything. Ella Ritz is one of the folks I turned to help with content. She was already creating kids programming at another institution. She's incredibly well organized. I knew that she was a talented artist, but little did I know how much incredible help she would be in creating the content. She's co-written the scripts with me. And what we decided to do is to go with a half-hour long presentation for the kids that is a virtual visit to Griffith Observatory. The first module, we take them to the observatory and talk about how we go through our lives observing. It's called Everyone is an Observer. But then we explore the idea that you can use technology to expand your capabilities to observe. We have telescopes up on the roof. We visit our famous 12-inch Zeiss refracting telescope. We talk about our famous Celestat, triple beam Celestat solar telescope. We explain what a spectrograph is. And the kids are really learning about what Griffith Observatory does as an observatory. And it's done live with museum guides and telescope demonstrators. So the interaction is live, just like the performances in our Samuel Ocean Planetarium. Griffith Observatory provides a unique experience for these kids. Even when the pandemic hit, it was not a pre-recorded experience for them.
I really love that because I feel like part of what's so special about the observatory is that ability to go there and meet people that are just as passionate about this kind of thing as you are and have those in-person interactions. And I was really heartened to hear that you were going to keep that in-person element, even in the virtual school program, because I think kids in particular want to know that they're being acknowledged and that they have someone who can like really answer their questions. So I think that was a good move strategically.
Well, thank you. And also, we include a long question and answer session in these visits, virtual visits. A lot of the students need that, and they need to know that they're getting their attention. In addition to the one module, we actually have three others that are operating. The second module is our comet demo, Clues from Comets, where we make a live kitchen comet in front of the students. We do it with a camera up above, kind of like a cooking show, so they can see the ingredients being added into the bowl. And it's a lot of fun. And we even made movies that take us on a visit to the surface of a comet. In fact, Ella put that video together from raw data from the mission that went there.
Which mission did you use the data from?
This was the Rosetta mission by the European Space Agency. I combed through every shot taken of Comet 67P Churyumov-Gerasimenko and created a stop motion video of the spacecraft approaching the comet. And what resulted was a very breathtaking and inspiring video showing how a comet moves in space and how the gases sublimate away once it approaches the sun.
I had a question for you, Sarah. What was your favorite thing that you got to teach the students that came to the in-person school program?
Oh, that is such a tricky one. Because I think being there in person and teaching the Let's Make a Comet show, when you get to put all these ideas together at the end and then pull this, you know, fake comet you made out of the materials in the stand, let the kids look at it, that was always really exciting. But for me, it was always that moment in front of the periodic table, where you're explaining where the elements in your body came from and how that relates to the stars. You always see at least one kid kind of looking at their hands afterwards, like you just fundamentally changed what it means to be human for them. So that was always my favorite. What about you guys?
I think seeing a student see a view through a telescope for the first time can be really exciting. And for the in-person school program, it's a view of the sun. And it can be a little tricky to put that into perspective of what am I actually seeing here? And we have to explain to the students. But you see the look on their face when they grasp the idea of they're seeing a storm on the sun, a magnetic storm that's bigger than the Earth. And that's what sunspots are for the most part. And we've got a lot of fun sunspots right now, everybody. So if you like sunspots, it's a great time to take a look at the sun. But seeing a student put the scale of the sun together and how small the Earth is in relation to that is one of my favorite moments.
I'd say my favorite things are a blend of what you two just said. Periodic table, it tells a story. I love talking about stars. It's something that they see every night twinkling in the night sky and also during the daytime. But showing them just how essential that star is to us and why, and how our placement in our solar system is just so to allow us to survive, just showing them like the greater context of why they're alive, connecting, you know, their real life experience of existing to something so cosmic. It blows their minds and it's so wonderful to witness and facilitate.
Yeah, finding your local observatory or any place to really take kids and engage with them is really important. I don't know if I've ever shared this with either of you, but the former host of this show, Matt Kaplan, actually fell in love with space as a kid visiting at Griffith Observatory. So that's where he gained that perspective on the universe, and it carried him all the way through 20 years of being the host of the show.
Yeah, well, Matt was wonderful, as you know, and he would visit Griffith Observatory once in a while, and he knew Laura Danley fairly well. But I got to meet him through her, and we tried to get him as a guest on All Space Considered, actually, to talk about it. And he kept saying, well, I don't do much. I'm just the host of the show. I'm thinking, oh my goodness, he doesn't understand the joy he's bringing to people in his role as the host of the show. It's pivotal to have someone there to, you know, focus our interests around.
How many students a year would you say go through the school program, you know, in the before time, but also now that it's virtual? Because I think we should put this in perspective, how many opportunities there are for people to be inspired. Because even if it's 1 in 1,000, that's a lot of lives you're changing.
If it's like previous years, where we had our full capacity. And again, I make no promises, but if it's like that, we can serve in a full year about 25 to 28,000 students in person. The online program, should it return, when it's running in full capacity, we serve somewhere around 100,000 student visits.
Well, thank you both for joining me and for everything you're doing to try to inspire the next generation. Because, you know, I've personally seen the impacts of this program and, you know, the amount of work that goes into it is not to be understated. And you both deserve so much credit.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And I just want to make sure this has been a team effort as well. I appreciate the credit, but Patrick So has helped. Our own observatory director, Dr. Krupp, has been super important for having this program succeed. So I just want to thank everybody that was involved. I can't name all the names, obviously, we'd be here forever, but just thanks to all that were involved in the program as well. Last thing I'd like to add is if you happen to be in Los Angeles on a Thursday mid-month, most third Thursdays, come on up and see us at All Space Considered. That's our live space news program that we do at Griffith Observatory. And if you're not in Los Angeles, check it out on YouTube. You can watch our program. We have a lot of old episodes there, past episodes. We have a lot of fantastic guests. And just, we have a lot of fun. So I hope you'll join us at All Space Considered.
It's a great show. I highly recommend it. And I'm not in any way biased by the fact that I worked on it for many years. But I mean that. You can learn so much. And there's so much coming out in space news every month that we can't even cover on our show. But you guys every month do a very deep dive into all of the newest space science. And I think people should check it out. Thanks, David and Ella. This has been really, really fun, and it's wonderful speaking to both of you again.
Great to talk to you, too, and thanks for having us.
Thank you so much.
You can hear the extended edition of my interview with Dr. David Reitzel and Ella Ritz in the podcast and online version of this show. That'll be at planetary.org/radio or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. We also share special updates on the Planetary Academy, which is the Planetary Society's membership program for kids, along with extra interviews from educators at Mount Wilson Observatory and other places in Los Angeles. We'll be right back for What's Up after this short break.
Ready to level up your space game? Hi, I'm Amber, Digital Community Manager for the Planetary Society, and we are launching our brand new digital member community. This is a place that's built exclusively for Planetary Society members. Here you can connect with fellow members from around the world, join live events you won't get anywhere else, and delve deeper into the wonders of our cosmos and the missions that explore them. It's all about putting the Society in the Planetary Society. I'll see you on the digital frontier.
Hello, I'm George Takei, and as you know, I'm very proud of my association with Star Trek. Star Trek was a show that looked to the future with optimism, boldly going where no one had gone before. I want you to know about a very special organization called the Planetary Society. They are working to make the future that Star Trek represents a reality. Boldly go to build our future.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio. And now it's time for What's Up with Bruce Betts, the chief scientist of the Planetary Society. Hey, Bruce.
Hey, Sarah.
With all this great conversations about all these people who are doing the good work to teach kids about space, I think something that I'm not sure a lot of people know about you is that you actually have a whole side hustle writing kids' space books.
You could call it that, but yes, I do. I've written six, and I've got more on the way for various ages, and it's been very rewarding.
It's cool seeing all that pay off with our Planetary Academy.
Yeah, that's also a wonderful program we've got going. I'm super excited about that and creating content for that. So all of it's neat. You lose track until you get some little note from a parent who said, hey, my kid wants to read this every night. Then it feels good.
How did you get into writing kids' space books?
I was actually recruited from other things I'd done. And so I got offers to write books. Then I've gotten very into it. But I've been doing on and off education related to space, going back to way back when I was doing field trips with dry ice and liquid nitrogen, talking about planets to kids who would visit our research institute. So it's been a long and exciting thing. I just missed the liquid nitrogen.
Same. Had some a lot of fun playing with liquid nitrogen, but it's always the dry ice chunks that I had the most fun with the kids. First thing they want to do is stick their hand right on it, and I've had to stop them many times.
Yeah, I really encourage. Oh wait, we don't. Yeah, that's why I stopped doing the stuff in person. The books are safer.
The books are safer. Well, if anybody wants to, you know, if anybody wants to take their kids out and show them what's going on in the night sky this week, what would you recommend for them?
Well, first of all, check out Astronomy for Kids by the wonderful author Bruce Betts. Sorry. Couldn't resist. We've got Venus almost at its highest point in the sky coming up in another couple weeks. Really up there, beautiful in the west. I'm just going to keep telling you because it's just so spectacular and easy to see after sunset now for a couple hours. And Mars is growing closer to it. Mars significantly dimmer, reddish, and up higher in the sky. And Jupiter starting to make its way up in the pre-dawn east, still quite low, and Saturn up above that. And this later part of May, Mercury is coming up very low to the horizon, below Jupiter in the pre-dawn. So if you've got a nice view to the east, you can check out Mercury above it, Jupiter much brighter, and significantly above them, yellowish Saturn. May 23rd in the evening in the west, the crescent moon is near Pollux and Castor and Pollux and Gemini, and between reddish Mars above and super bright Venus below. So it'll be a lovely grouping going on May 23rd.
I always like to go outside during this time of year and go look up at Castor and Pollux because my mom has an identical twin sister. So I always really like to go out and see Gemini.
Wait, your mom's Castor or Pollux?
Ooh, that's an interesting question. I'll have to think on that
one. Oh, it wasn't philosophical. Sorry. Let's move on to this week in space history, shall we? Because stuff happened. Apollo 10 launched in 1969 to go practice landing on the moon, but stopping many kilometers short on purpose in preparation for Apollo 11 a couple months later. And in 2010, the Japanese Space Agency launched Icarus, which became the first successful solar sail spacecraft, deployed from Akatsuki on its way to Venus and demonstrated solar sailing. They had a lot of impressive stuff on it. It was about 300 kilograms compared to LightSail 2, which was the second spacecraft to demonstrate controlled solar sailing from the Planetary Society. When we were 5 kilograms, so it's a different class, but congratulations 13 years later once again to the Icarus team, because it's impressive.
It really is. I'm only just a little jealous that they got there first, but it's not a race. We're all working together.
Yeah, okay, right. we go on to random space facts. This one's one you may know, but I just thought, you know, we'd revisit and make sure people are aware of this kind of basic of the random space facts. So Earth's orbital plane defines the ecliptic, and the biggest variation among the 8 classical planets is Mercury is about 7 degrees its plane to the ecliptic. And that's followed by Venus at 3.4 degrees from the ecliptic. And then all the other planets are closer to 1 or approaching 0.
I wonder what happened to Mercury that caused that.
It's still hard for Mercury to talk about it. Let's just put it that way.
Well, we're here for you, Mercury, if you ever want to talk.
Indeed, indeed. Shall we go on to the trivia contest, in which I asked the incredibly important question, what is the official name or designation for NASA's toilet on the ISS, which is also to be used on Artemis 2? How'd we do?
People loved this one. Anything toilet related in space, people always, always enjoy. Our winner this week is Kirk Zorb from Denver, Colorado, USA. And the answer they sent in is the Universal Waste Management System, or UWMS. That's the answer for this question. Although I loved that they also wrote in that they should have called it the Everything Waste System, or EWS.
EWS. Oh, that's much better. I can't believe this one's so unpronounceable. Maybe we'll do a future contest of acronyms for toilets in space, but not this time.
What's funny about this, the fact that you bring up the naming contest, a couple people wrote in because they were a little confused because there was a naming contest in 2009. They were naming the Node 3 module on the ISS that included a toilet. And at the time, Stephen Colbert, who's like a late night talk show host here in the United States, asked his audience on his show, The Colbert Report, to write in and tell NASA that they should name this node with its toilet, the Colbert. And 230,000 people voted for him. So a few people wrote in to say that it was named Colbert because they remember that he won that contest. But in the end, NASA decided to go with this less pronounceable name, and they gave Colbert a consolation prize, which was a treadmill, which they named the Combined Operational Load-Bearing External Resistance Treadmill, or the Colbert.
One note on the Universal Waste Management System with the terribly unpronounceable acronym, Universal, because it's designed to be able to be used in different spacecraft. So ISS, in a different back end, you might say, of the system is employed on Artemis II, but it's the same basic system.
We also got a lot of people writing in with jokes about boldly going where no one had gone before.
Oh, my.
I had a fun one reading through people's messages this week, is all I can say. It was great.
All right, we'll revisit this popular and disturbing topic in the future, I guarantee.
But what's our next trivia contest question?
For now, we're going to go a little more classical and go to Shakespearean literature.
Ooh.
Where in the solar system is there a crater named Macbeth? Go to planetary.org/radio contest.
Just don't send in your answer while you're inside of a theater. And you have until May 24th at 8 a.m. Pacific time to get us your answer. So our winner this week is going to receive a Goodnight Oppie thermal mug.
I will not be a part of these superstitions.
Here's Bruce just yelling Macbeth in a theater.
Yeah, they get really mad.
I wonder what the astronomy equivalent is. Is there something you could shout in an observatory that would make everyone antsy?
Earthquake?
That would do it.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about boil, boil, toil and trouble, and stuff like that. Thank you, and good night.
We've reached the end of this week's episode of Planetary Radio, but we'll be back next week with Shubham Kanodia. He's the lead author on a paper about a forbidden planet that probably shouldn't exist. And before we go, I want to send a huge thank you to everybody out there who spends any time at all sharing the love of space and science with young people. Every moment you spend trying to teach science to a young person and inspiring them to think bigger or feel more welcome, you're shaping a better future for humanity. And someday when we're out there sailing among the stars, it will be partly your fault. So think about that the next time you're looking up at the night sky. Planetary Radio is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and is made possible by our amazing members, both young and old. Mark Hilverda and Ray Pauletta are our associate producers. Andrew Lucas is our audio editor. Josh Doyle composed our theme, which was arranged and performed by Peter Schlosser. And until next week, Ad Astra.